Blog Talk Radio.
Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. You're listening once again to another edition of Religion Means Alive. I'm your host, Imam Alfred, the host of Religion Means Alive. We're waiting today for our guest, Khadir El-Amin, the son of Imam Earl El-Amin. We're going to have a discussion with him regarding the book, Rituals of Blood, and other topics of intellectual interest. We thank you for your time, certainly your attention. These are some very serious times in the life of our people as Muslims, serious time for life of the African American. And I was wondering, is our dear friend and brother Muhammad Sharif, a great worker in the cause of the Imam Muhammad community, will give us a report on the convention planning. I've heard his wonderful voice on the convention meeting. I think he's also working with the Ramadan session. Can I call on you? If I can, press one. If not, I won't bother you. But you're such a powerful soldier, an example of a hard worker, that always identifying good causes and get involved with them. And while we're waiting for our guests, I would love to have you to give us a report and tell us about the convention plan. Assalamu alaikum.
Yeah, wa alaikum assalam, Imam Alfred Muhammad.
How are you, my dear brother?
Oh, I'm good. Praise be to Allah.
All praises is due to Allah. Allah has blessed us immensely as a people. And I was just wondering if you would just give us a report about the convention, tell us about it, why we should be there, and why are you going to be there?
Well, last I heard, I think Imam Hamid Rasul had spoke the last time on the call, and you had invited him to come on and give a report, so I would hold up and let Imam Rasul, when he comes on, let him get a report because he got it more updated than I have, you know?
Yes, sir. Well, we thank you. I think our guest has arrived. Brother Khadir El-Amin, the son, wonderful son of Imam Earl El-Amin, and you stand by, and we're going to get a report from you or anybody. I mean, you serve on the convention committee, planning committee. I'm on the convention planning committee, so all of us can, while we may not have a detailed report, we know the convention is going to be held the last weekend in the month of August in the great city of Tinley Park, Illinois. Registration is taking place now. You can go to Moss Care's website. So that's the extent of the report, and also the Ramadan sessions will be held at Moss Care's headquarters. So we will have the report from the people. And we want to keep people appraised of the convention and the Ramadan session, which will be held at 939 East 171st Street, East Hazelcrest, Illinois. That is 18th, 19th, 20th of July. I was born on the earth some 18 years ago and around that time. So thank you, my dear brother. Brother Khadir El-Amin, are you on the line?
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Welcome, Brother Khadir El-Amin from Baltimore, Maryland, by the way of Lincoln University. Welcome to Religion Means Alive.
Oh, thank you.
One of the things I'm so fascinated by is that you're one of the second generation members of the community, Imam W.D. Muhammad, and you're a second generation attendee at the historical African-American colleges and universities. Will you give us a background information on Lincoln University and why you decided to choose Lincoln University?
Well, Lincoln University is HBCU, as you know. And for me, being an African-American, you know, I felt like for me to go to it was, you know, important that I go to HBCU, but that also that I choose the right one, and I chose Lincoln because it's a little ways away from my city, but not too far. But
now, what is the academic life like at Lincoln?
I mean, well, Lincoln right now has a very good academic programs having to do with science and especially environmental science. But it's well known for having graduates such as Edward Blyden, Thurgood Marshall, and Kwame Nkrumah.
Well, that is Zequa. You sound like you're in very good company. So you are one of the future leaders of the globe. What I like about you, Brother Qadir, is that, you know, I've taught students over the years, formally and informally, and I give them a reading list, and they come back as bad as Verda Mae Grosvenor told me one time. He gave a student an assignment to read Malcolm X's autobiography. The student came back and said, I couldn't find anything on Malcolm 10. But unfortunately, you're not one of those students. I gave you a reading list. And I wanted you to kind of tease out for us this reading list that I'm going to discuss with you, one of the books I have right in my hands, and your impressions of that book. Can you recall for the audience some of those books that I suggested that you read, in addition to the books your dad had suggested?
Well, one of the books was, it was called Rituals of Blood by Orlando Patterson. And
what is your impression of Rituals of Blood? Has it given you any understanding of what happened to the African Americans?
Well, in his book, he discusses and pinpoints different causes of what I would call destruction of the African American life. You know, and destruction of the African-American, his mentality, and on a wider scale, a social scale, a social circle. And he talks about not just slavery, but Jim Crow and after the abolition of slavery up to modern times as repeated oppression that has had a serious effect on the African-American psyche.
I'm going to read for you a section of Patterson's book with his introduction and ask you to make a comment. No group of people, no experience illustrates this more vividly than those of African Americans. Yeah, let me reread the start here because it doesn't, this is not possible to make sense of modern American families and so-called family values without understanding the revolution in gender roles that came with the rapid growth of women participation in the workforce over the past half century. When a woman works, they become more independent economically. If they are independent economically, they're less willing to put up an unhappy marriage. And if they divorce more frequently, their attitudes and values about marriage and divorce change accordingly. No group of people and no experience illustrates this more vividly than those of African Americans. He calls them Afro-Americans. I don't like that term. There's a crisis in nearly every aspect, all aspects of gender relations among classes of African American. It is getting worse. Before it became the rigueur for academics and other advocates of African Americans to deny behavioral and commercial problems, cultural problems, the crisis was widely acknowledged and deplored by all thoughtful African-Americans. When the sociologist and jazz musician Charles Keel wrote in 1966, for the vast majority of Negroes, the battle of the sex is no more figure of speech. In the ghetto, men and women are considered to be separate and antagonistic species. And this has been an override to minor distinction of creed, class, and color. The remarks for all his exaggeration went unchallenged, largely because most African-American men at the time acknowledged the seriousness of the problem. African-American women were even more emphatic in recognizing and lamenting the problem. What is your comment on what Professor Patterson starts out with in terms of a challenge in his introduction?
Well, one thing I noticed in the book is he says that African-Americans are the most isolated people in really the world. in America also. But, and he says this because men and women are really, they really do not get along in the African-American community. They are working against each other. And he talks about how slavery, the institution of slavery, bred jealousy amongst the black man and the black woman. So I see that.
Do you find that to be true, or do you think that Professor Patterson is just engaging in rhetorical flourishes? Does it have any truth to it, a ring of truth?
Well, I think what he's saying is true because he's citing different sources, actual instances of it. So I think what he's saying has truth to it, but in order to see what he's saying as being true, you'd have to have read other things relating to this issue. From the just reading his book, not having any background knowledge about the topic, you would say, "Oh, he's just, you know, he's just talking." But reading other pieces of literature on slavery and the effects of slavery in African American culture, I would have to say that what he's saying is true.
Now, you have read, and your father and I have had discussions about it, and your father kind of rekindled my interest in the great historian John Blatnagame. Does this ring true at all, what Professor Patterson has to say?
Well, one thing I noticed about Orlando Patterson's Rituals of Blood is that he says that in the 1970s there were pieces of literature written by these so-called revisionists, and they wanted to recreate the idea of slavery, warping it from one extreme of being told that slavery and African Americans doing slavery was Sambo's and Uncle Tom's, to that the slave was well adjusted to the plantation and did not have it that bad, and he was doing all right. But looking at Blatnagame's book and the year it was printed, I would think that his book, that he was a revisionist, but he is not. Blatnagame's book takes accounts of actual slaves, notably Frederick Douglass, Josiah Henson, Moses Roper, and others, and uses them to create a picture of the plantation in the South. So I would say that, you know, after reading Blatnagame's book on slavery and certain things that he cites, you know, I would say that the effect that Orlando Patterson is trying to show us of slavery is true. You know, of course, not everything on the plantation was as I don't want to say as bad, but of course, every plantation was not the same. But there were instances of tremendous, tremendous psychological trauma amongst African Americans on plantations. So I say, yeah, it gives a good picture and a good introduction to reading his book, Orlando Patterson's book.
Y'all, don't you know, close the door. I'm on the air. Excuse me, gentlemen, we're having a slight. All right. One of the things that I thought that was very important about your observation, that we are on the same page, is the isolation, the extent of isolation that exists among African Americans. Patterson goes on to say, and I agree with him, he says that I have found that the African Americans are today as isolated internally from each other as they are isolated externally from a group, from other Americans. However, while their external isolation is still serious, yet declining as I demonstrated in the ordeal of integration, their internal isolation is getting worse. The root cause of this internal isolation, I argue, is the sorry state of relations between men and women. African Americans have the lowest rate of marriage in the nation, and those who do get married have the highest rate of divorce of any major ethnic group. The result is that most African Americans, especially women, will go through most of their adult life as single people. But, you know, I think that there's something even stronger going on here. And I don't think Patterson is really equipped to deal with it or honest enough to deal with it. And that is the isolation between African-American men and African-American men. That, in other words, this isolation, the lack of male bonding and role modeling, creates a tremendous gap. One of the things I know about your family, you had a strong grandfather. You have a strong father. You have a strong uncle. And that has uniquely equipped you. And I want to ask you, what have you observed about your fellow classmates at Lincoln University in terms of the male bonding? It seems to me this kind of a cursory observation of African Americans. Most of us have a tendency to be isolated from each other. We don't have the collegial kind of relationships. We have sort of a standout. The guys from Baltimore will not hang out with the guys from D.C. I mean, part of it is territorial. Just would you comment on that?
Well, coming from, well, at Lincoln, one thing I noticed was things were not that much different from when I was in high school in terms of the social circles at my high school. I went to a high school in Baltimore called Paul Lawrence Dunbar High School, a public school. And one thing I noticed about my peers is, you know, I noticed immediately when I came to high school was that they didn't grow up like me. They were not of the same upbringing. Most of the people I knew lived with single mothers, you know, and seeing things in high school, I noticed that, you know, a lot of the fights, a lot of the way we talk about each other, you know, especially black males, you know, we really do not like each other, get along with each other, and it's because we don't have that in our background. We don't have, you know, I guess I want to say fathers, you know, a lot of us. A lot of African-American males. But when I came to Lincoln, I noticed the same thing held true, you know, and especially with this whole college atmosphere, there's an element that comes in, and that's the fraternal element. And I noticed that a lot of black males, you know, a lot of the people run to these, are attracted to these fraternities and stuff because they're getting something that they didn't get when they were, you know, younger. That's the way I look at it nowadays. Not the principles that these organizations were founded on, but because they want to belong, because they want to be amongst, find a way to, I guess, be amongst other black males, and that's become the last resort. You know, what you see on the streets, we have gangs, and then on the college atmosphere, you have fraternities. You know, and as black males, if that's what it takes for us to come together, you know, it's a very sad thing, you know.
Now, Patterson goes on to argue, and I believe he's quite right in his argument. He said the typical African-American has a much smaller network of friends and kinsmen than any other American do. And what was most unexpected, the proportion of the members of this attenuated network who are kinsmen is smaller than in any American network. There are no hoods out there, which is precisely why murderous gangs like opportunistic social cancer rush to fill the vacuum. Now, one of the things I was really struck by what you said about this isolation, and somewhere in this work, Patterson goes on to say, despite all of the family reunions, in spite of all of the conventions and all of the things, we still are a very isolated people. Do you believe that's true?
I do believe it's true because, you know.
And if so, why?
We'll say, we'll say, oh, okay, we're going to the family, we're going to this family reunion, you know, wherever it may be, up north or down south, and we'll see our family. But, you know, we really, besides those instances, unless we live in the same, you know, tight-knit communities, we don't see each other. And I noticed with my family, my mother's side of my family, I have family members in North Carolina who, if they see each other all the time because they live around each other. And I guess I relate this to, you know, the great migration having an effect on African-Americans. On my mother's side of my family up here in Baltimore, I don't see them as much, you know. I see my grandmother a lot because she lives in the same neighborhood, but my other cousins and, you know, uncles I have, countless, I don't see them as much. And, you know, we're isolated because we're going to be isolated if the family life is not there. If the family life is not there, of course, we're going to be isolated from each other, you know. And another thing, like Orlando Patterson says, African-Americans having the smallest social circles. I attribute that to us, our distrust of each other, you know. And it's not that we...
That is vitally important. Yes.
It's not that
and
we...
And why do you think
that
distrust took place?
Can you repeat the question?
Why do you think this distrust takes place?
I mean, it's not out of nowhere. It's for good reason, I think, because just speaking from personal experience, you know, growing up, and, like, it is hard to, I guess, when you're growing up amongst people, you know, and the majority of people I knew growing up, black males, like, they came from really, really bad situations, you know, and I guess they didn't trust me, and seeing the things they do to each other, it's hard to trust them, so.
Yeah, it's sad to say, but it's true.
It's sad to say, yeah, it's one of those things, it's a sad commentary, but it's true, you know. I don't want my dad calls it the Ashton Daddy Club, and, you know, being around, I know that I can't hang around, just from my experience, I know I can't hang around those kind of people because they're different from me, but seeing how they treat each other, you know, it's just rotten. It's just another reason, you know. I just see it. The distrust is there, and it's because of slavery. It's definitely because of slavery, after slavery, Jim Crow. All these things had an impact on how we...
Great migration intensified the alienation. And, you know, one of the things that I'm struck, my family is from, I think, the same county that your mother's family, on my paternal side. Is the same county that your mother's from, Buckingham County, and my family is the Holmans, the Bookers, and the Gordon. And I have, you know, what I find almost laughable, I hate to say it's laughable, but I have family members that will invite me to family reunions to meet with thousands of family members that I don't know. But I ask them, well, what about my niece that just graduated from Georgetown? They won't even tell me anything about that. I hope one of them aren't listening. I hope they all listen. Maybe they can heal. Why is it that we are so excited about somebody we don't know, but the person that lives right in our neighborhood, our own cousin, maybe our own sister, our own brother? We don't want to find them out, but we'd rather find some 10th, 15th cousin, maybe even a first cousin that lives in Texas we won't see again until there's more fried chicken. We won't see them again until there's some more corn pudding. Y'all obviously know I'm hungry. Some cornbread. There's really no substantive conversation. I was in one town recently, and there were 500 African-Americans there, and I know they must have spent close to $100,000 at least to get to this family reunion. But there was very little substance of what Patterson calls it is, and you all can join the conversation at 805-727-7013 called Broken Bloodline, Gender Relations, and the Crisis of Marriage and Family Among African Americans. But I think Patterson is a little bit off base. I don't think that he gets to it until we see that African Americans have learned how to distrust each other. We didn't come from Africa distrusting each other. And I want you to kind of comment here on kind of contrast for us. Patterson and some of your findings in the work of John Blasphemy Game. Now, I must tell the audience there's a difference. Blasphemy Game is an African American. Orlando Patterson is an African West Indian. So he has a different lens in which to look upon us. Now, if I were to question Professor Patterson about the West Indies, we may get another finding. And I have read his book, and I would recommend to our audience that you read The Sociology of Slavery by Orlando Patterson. I happen to know Professor Patterson as well. So would you just give us your comment on that?
I feel like, first, I do think I thought about this in reading it, that he could be a little bit off base and have a different opinion than African American would have, because he is a West Indian, and we have to look at the history, really, the history of slavery, and he's Jamaican actually, and looking at the history of Jamaica, they were also enslaved, but the system of slavery for them was different. It allowed them to retain more of their culture than we would have been able to do. And seeing that, he might be looking at African Americans in a different way than say Blasphemy Game would. But John Blasphemy Game, his picture of slavery that's painted is a very good one. It's a very honest one because he's using actual accounts. Now, he describes in his book the plantation, but he also describes the personality types on the plantation. But one thing he talks about...
Can you describe for us the six personalities of Blasphemy Game?
Well, if you would allow me to get my notes, I could do that.
Yes, sir. And while you're getting your notes, just tell us what you major in at Lincoln University. And I must tell you, while you're getting your notes, I've already given you an A on this paper, this oral presentation.
Thank you. I'm a mass communications major.
Why you chose that major?
Because it relates to what I would like to do in life, and I look at a lot of films, and film is what I'm interested in. And mass communications is a field that has a lot of film related aspects of it.
Mm-hmm. You can join the conversation at 805-727-7013, 805-727-7013. We're speaking with Khadir El-Amin. He is a student at Lincoln University, a mass communications major, and he is a young man that is definitely on his way to the destiny. He is a young man that's has studied. What fascinated me, usually give young people a reading list, you don't hear no more from them, include some of my own children. But I'm so happy that he was, I don't remember the other books. When you get an opportunity, you can share with us the other books I've given you. I think we talked about The Mark of Oppression and some of the others that were given. Tell us when you found your notes.
I just found them. And Blasphemy Game, he gives a description of several different personalities that existed on southern plantations. And one thing to keep in mind is he said that not every slave was docile. and submissive. The slaves' submissiveness depended on the plantation. A plantation with a more sadistic master would have more docile slaves compared to a plantation with a master who was more lenient, I would say.
So, in other words, it did pay a slave master to be cruel if he wanted control of his slave. But even some of those cruel ones found themselves getting knocked upside the head, like your great fellow Baltimorean Frederick Douglass. I mean, he had a cruel slave master, and that slave master paid with being knocked out.
Yeah, in his fight with Mr. Cuffy.
Yeah. Mr. Cuffy got a stiff uppercut, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Let me ask you this. Why are we talking about mass communication in film? Can you see the possibilities of doing a movie on slave rebellion?
I think it would be necessary, but at the same time, I had this conversation at school with a friend of mine, and he said that he didn't like 12 Years a Slave because the black man didn't rise up like he was supposed to. But I told him 12 Years a Slave is based on a true story, so I believe that always keeping it honest, you know, because it's not always greener on the other side.
Right. Well, as a filmmaker and mass communicator guy, how would you bring the story of the ritual of blood of the similar situated story to the center, to the big screen?
The best way to do it would be a documentary. You know, the things he describes are issues that affect African Americans today. You know, and I could name countless people who I know who have been brought up in these kind of homes that Orlando Patterson describes, and people who are going through these issues, relatives, friends. This is a real issue in our community, and the best way to do it wouldn't be to write anything fictional. It would just be to describe what's going on right now.
Could that kind of subject be submitted to fiction? Is there any way to handle that with fiction? Or we see the work of Anne Frank. We see the work of Schindler's List. Is there any way we can deal with that and make it entertainment at the same time? Is that a possibility?
No possibility. But
okay, so because we would get the situation. Well, I must tell you, I went to see Mississippi Burning, and I think until we have done some healing, I don't know how affected these things are. I went to see Mississippi Burning, and a Caucasian was sitting next to me, and he was eating popcorn. And my fantasy was to take the popcorn and just put it down his throat and kill it. And I had to restrain myself from doing it. I must tell you, when this African-American was being beat and kicked and stomped, I don't think we're now yet ready to deal with that. Do you?
I think that the African Americans, I honestly think that they're not equipped to deal with it yet. They're not equipped because movies like 12 Years a Slave recently or Belle, which recently came out, we will go see these movies, but they go right over our head, you know. So I think that
why would you say it would go over our head?
Because the true meaning and the jewels that have been dropped in these films that only a person who had background knowledge of these topics that the films are based on would see. You know, in 12 Years a Slave, we see several different personalities. You know, in the beginning, when he was on the riverboat going down south, there was a slave who was chained with a muzzle. And this slave was—he was killed immediately. He was trying to overtake the ship, and somehow obtain his freedom. And there was also another slave who acted as if he was trying to do something, but once brought to the slave market, he jumped in his master's arm. So right there we see two different personalities. We see Nat, and we see Tom. But
what do you think Tom was doing when he jumped in the master's lap? You think Tom was happy or Tom was just strategizing?
I don't think what hit me was that he was one of those people who acted like he was, you know, trying to do something, and then when the opportunity came to go back to his master, he jumped at it. So that gave me the impression that he had a Tom like personality.
Okay, but Tom was also very skillful in kind of creating an affection for Master, to kind of try to negotiate better treatment for himself. Maybe he wasn't so interested in the group, but he certainly might have been interested in the individual. You can join the conversation at 805-727-7013. We're speaking with Brother Abir Elamini. He's a student at Lincoln University, and he's given us a very, very extraordinarily intelligent rendering. You know, people think that the commute to Imam Deputy Muhammad would end after Imam Muhammad's passed, but we see that this commute is more vibrant. This is a second generation. He hasn't lost a touch. I'm telling you, he pulls his notepad out and he starts taking notes and starts reading some of these books. And this summer, now remember, he's not doing this for a course. He's doing it because he wants to learn about our people and learn about our ordeals and how we can triumph. Because, I mean, 12 years a slave is also a victory over the human spirit. Much as some of us may look at it and see it as a degrading thing, this man was still able to keep his dignity. I must honestly tell you, I haven't seen the film. I have. Last one of those films I watched was Roots. I'm not yet able to tolerate that kind of treatment. What happened to it. I'm just wondering whether cinematographically it can be done. I'm going to ask you about another documentary that's out by Professor Skip Gates. It is called Many Rivers to Cross, I believe. What do you think of that movie, of that documentary?
Skip Gates, in my opinion, he's a good historian. He's good at laying out what happened during slavery, but he doesn't really go in depth. He doesn't look at it with a deeper lens. You know, he gives a good layout from, you know, bringing the slaves to our country up, I guess the civil rights movement, but he doesn't talk about reasons for why this happened or what happened. But look at the information that he provides in it. It's good information, but it's not. You never get his opinion. But Many Rivers was a good. It was a good special. It was a good special. It had some good information in it.
It also seems that Professor Gates would like to overlook the role that Islam, the Nation of Islam, is playing in breaking the psychological grip of slavery. Have you noticed that as well?
Well, I see that he doesn't really deal with Islam that much. But you have to look at him and who he's doing this for. You know,
he's writing this for? You think what audience do you think he's trying to reach?
To be frank, his audience is white people.
And what he would like? What do you think he's trying to tell the white people?
He just, you know. Okay, this is slavery. This is what happened, but not really. But this is not really, you know, this is not the African American's perspective, or even his own perspective. You know,
you think he's trying to tell us that everything is okay?
Yeah, he is. He is.
Professor Muhammad of the Schoenberg, he told him that he should include Islam, and instead he decided to bring Maulana Ron Karinga. And Maulana Ron Karinga, to my knowledge, is not a Muslim, even though he's from Maryland. I think he had some brief introduction to the temple. He identifies with a tribal religion called Qaeda, which is a made-up religion that doesn't even exist because African Americans didn't come from the East Coast of Africa. They came from the West Coast of Africa. So I think Professor Gates would like to hide that. Now, you can join the conversation at 805- 727 7013. We have the light is lit from Brother Muhammad Sharif. Did you want to make comments, Brother Muhammad Sharif? Any comments, 805-727-7013. Let me ask you this, Brother Qadir. What effect did it have? What, just give us about two or three things that reading this book brought out to you.
Some of the information that he gives in here, one thing it brought out to me was the major disparity of relationships, you know, marriage amongst black people, especially the part about most of us being single people for the majority of our life and having the highest divorce rate if we get married. You know, those are major things that I thought were, you know, those are things that are wild. You know, you can't build a civilization like that. You know.
Let me ask you this. What about your classmates? Are they thinking about getting married? What's on the men's mind?
Oh, well, of course, black females have been given this storybook image of what marriage is, you know, and they've been given this image by the forces that be. But I guess I don't think black males think about it as much as they do. You know?
What are your classmates thinking about? What's predominant on their minds?
Most of them are probably thinking about graduating from college, getting a good job, and being successful in America, you know, which is a very shallow idea. But that's probably what they're thinking about. They're thinking if they get a job.
What is their opinion of our people and the state of our people? Are they hopeful? Are they optimistic? Are they pessimistic? What's their feelings?
I like to say that, you know, sad to say, they're at their lowest point. They can't go any lower than this. This is the end of the whole, from slavery through Jim Crow to the Civil Rights Movement. The crack era. This is the end of the line right here. And
do you believe
like
that we're
that,
on our way back up?
Yeah, I do, because the African American.
You know what? And I do too. And I'm gonna tell you, you're a powerful sign of that. Is that you are a young man that is in college. Let me just ask you. Give us. If you could share with us, I don't recall all the books I've given you to read, but I would like for you to share with us this reading list. Some of those books that just kind of tell us, well, frankly, I must tell you, I was just impressed that you would even accept the reading list. I have children that, biological children, won't accept my reading list. But I know if we're going to develop a thinking group of people, I don't care if you've been to the Kaaba 10,000 times, can read Arabic and fluent in reading the Quran. If you don't understand what has happened and is happening with us, but mostly what has happened to us, because what is happening to us is a direct relationship to what has happened to us. So will you share with us, if you recall, that reading list we gave you?
Well, I recall Rituals of Blood and the Mark of a Penance.
Yes.
I'm currently reading Rituals of Blood. I have yet to purchase the other book.
Oh, you know what? Let me tell you something. Rituals of Blood is rich enough, and the Mark of Oppression is just really kind of a continuation, more of a psychological state of what happened to our people. It's a clinical study. It's kind of dry. But Rituals of Blood is a very... We're going to go back to Rituals of Blood, and you can join the conversation at 805-727-7013. I see we have our brother from Orlando, Florida, And we'll talk about Orlando Patterson. I'm going to read some more here and ask you to give your reaction.
Okay.
My analysis belies two myths that are often offered up by apologists in their attempt to deny and obscure this tragedy. Now, he's talking about how the African-Americans are isolated from each other. And he goes on to say, my analysis belies two myths that are often offered up by apologists in their attempt to deny and obscure this tragedy. One is that African-Americans have developed alternate form of lasting and viable gender relations and alternated models of child rearing. While such alternate and institutional arrangements have existed in the rural South among the early generations of migrants north, although always precarious, as Richard Wright and Ralph Ellis among others disclosed, there's no evidence for this, as I would show alternative America's cohabitation are even more volatile and disrupted at even a greater rate than marriage. Nor is there a shred of evidence that male kinsmen and friends of single mothers provide alternate male role models for African-American boys and girls. Do you agree with that or disagree with that?
He said that they can. I agree. They cannot be provide sufficient role models for African-American.
You know
boys.
What? I'm the moderator, but I'm going to agree with you. You know, I think the biggest bunch of myths that took place on the 60s, it was a cover-up on our people's part by our leaders, our social scientists, who said, well, you know, most uncles are not in their sons, in their nephews' life. I'm not in my own nieces and nephews' lives. Only one of my nieces, I'm in their lives, and her father was not there. But I have nieces, I have nephews, I even have grandchildren whose fathers have disappeared, and I'm marginally, because I live in one state, they live in another, I'm marginally involved. So I think we are making up a lot of myths. I don't believe, except in the case of grandparents who are sometimes forced to take care of children, I don't think they're involved. I think we are frightened. And I want to ask you this. Why do you think we're so frightened of the truth about our state?
Because it's you know, one thing about the truth is, you know, you can either accept it or you can turn your back on it. If you turn your back on it, it's gonna eat you up, you know. And the truth, I believe, like, just reading it, you know, it's so shocking to know this stuff about our people, especially reading Rituals of Blood. It's so shocking. And really, in this point in time, African Americans aren't a people who like truth. We don't like truth right now, you know. We don't want to hear it. We'd rather say that, okay, Obama's president, black women are doing well. That's a sign for all of us. They're doing well in college and graduating from college. That's a sign for all of us, and we'd rather just call it a day. You know, we'd rather not really look at things with a critical eye, you know, and notice what's going on. We don't want to
do that. What about African American Muslims? Do they suffer from the same problem?
Well, the they're black too, but the African American Muslims.
I like that.
The African American Muslims, under the illusion that because he's a Muslim, he has been removed from the situation that the majority of black Americans face. Most of us like to run and hide, and the African American Muslim thinks he can hide behind Islam. You know, the rest of his people are so-called Kafirs. You know, no, but that's not the truth. You know, we can't do that. We have to help our people as a whole, you know.
Yes, and in other words, just being a Muslim is not an escape valve from being an African-American. Neither should it be desired. We have the same problem. We have marital problems. We have economic. We are part of our people. And I think we have better solutions in developing our human consciousness, but at the same time that we engage in this denial, we would not be good. Tell us more about this. Is what year are you now at Lincoln University?
I'm a rising sophomore.
Rising sophomore. What does it mean to be a rising sophomore?
To me, it means it's my second year. You know. So I look
and,
to
and you chose Lincoln. Again, give us a reason for your choice of Lincoln University. It's a lovely university.
Because it was not too far, but it was close at the same time, and I liked the environment. It was small. It was a small school, not too big. I wouldn't be just a number, an ID number. I'd be, who I am. I'd be Cadell and me, and the teachers would know me, and it would be a better place for me to. It would be a better plan for me, playing field for me academically.
Now, I want to ask you, why did you go to Towson State, Salisbury State, John Hopkins? Why did you decide to go to an African American school?
It's I'd be the third generation of in my family of going to HBCUs, but also the fact that those schools, though I often wonder what the knowledge they're getting up there and what that's helping them do. I feel like I wouldn't fit, I wouldn't socially. It's nothing, I've met a lot of friends my first year. I met a lot of friends, and I feel like at a predominantly white institution, I wouldn't have met those kind of people and had those kind of relationships,
Yes. And what is the faculty like? Is the majority of the faculty African American?
Sadly, no.
Oh. What are the majority of the faculty members?
They got a lot of Africans and people from the West Indies.
Well, let me ask you this. Why do they relate to you as a student?
You said, why do they relate to me?
How do they relate to you? Is it a warm, open relationship? Is there an opportunity for mentoring?
I would say with those teachers, I wouldn't get that from a teacher, a foreign teacher. I wouldn't get that because they've been educated in a different manner, and they see education as having a different purpose. I'm the student, they're the teacher, that's that. But I have met teachers, my first semester that were very very good, and I go talk to a lot. Like my teacher, my freshman, I had a class called freshman year. It was called freshman year, and they just helped us get acclimated as students. But my teacher, I had Mr. Denson. He was a teacher. He knew a lot of the stuff. Same stuff I read. J. A. Rogers, John Blasingame, and I always often have conversations with him, and sometimes debates with him about different stuff. So some teachers, they are good. They would make good mentors, but one thing I have to say about the HBCUs, they need more African American teachers because I noticed that it's easier to relate to, the student better, and we relate to the teachers better, when the teachers have the same experiences as us and are,
Yeah, and that was the reason I think for a lot of us wanted to go to the African American school. We have a caller from 347. I believe it's Imam Mubashir Akhtar. But Imam Mubashir Akhtar, you're on the air with Religion Means Alive. Yes. And Brother Qadir Elamin. Yes, sir.
Oh, assalamu alaikum, Brother Imam and Brother Qadir.
Wa alaikum assalam.
Brother Imam, I had to take the hat off to you, man. You go find some people to come up with some very, very interesting information for our mind, our heart, and our soul, Brother Imam. And I appreciate that. I agree with you. What we're scared to talk about things that we shouldn't be afraid to talk about because the time is right. I was listening to you from the beginning, and I will have on my table a book by Imam Muhammad called "The Champion We Have in Common: The Dynamic African American Soul." And this is part two. It's four books. This is part two, and it's in a historical perspective. By the son of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, founder and builder of the nation of Islam. Now, buddy, now, my soul is not the soul of a person that's born on the West Indian Isle. My soul is not a soul of a person born in Latin America. My soul is not the soul of a person that was born in Africa or Asia or China or Arabia. As an African-American that was born from the people that was put in slavery in this part of the world called North America, we have a unique soul, and the language of that soul is uniquely different from most other souls on this planet Earth. There's no soul on this earth that have gone like the soul of the African-American or people that was brought from Africa and put in slavery here in America. We are the children of those people. And our language, the language of our soul, is different from the language of all the rest of the people's soul. Your soul is a language, too. And when we say what is the language of Imam Muhammad, the reason why Imam Muhammad is able to reach so many people is because he is connected back to the soul that God created his soul to be in. When we look at this guy named Skip Gates, I watched him, buddy, now, when he came on with that, when he was going back in the DNA, he was approaching a lot of the celebrities that had money. And I seen when he had went back with Oprah Winfrey. And Oprah Winfrey told him, said, look, now, I better find out I came from the Mandingo tribe or Warden tribe. Now, what do you think that he did? He made sure that's the tribe that she came from because she paid him big money. Now, we have been blessed to see and understand, but now, we cannot go back in Africa at all, find out where we come from. And that's what I think is wrong with many of the so-called historians and things, because they are trying to connect us back to something that God allowed not to happen. God ain't going to allow that to happen because God said he's going to make a new people. We are that new people. So they have us working against God's plan. God said he's the one that created you in the womb of your mother as he pleases, as he pleases. So all the womb that produced us, Brother Nam, a mind like yours, your mind is like that, Brother Nam, because you was born from the spirit of people that was put in captivity in this part of the world. I was dealing with down at the bookstore, but now, and this imam from Jamaica, they was challenging me because I was telling them about my experience, that I experienced in the South coming up, what affected my soul of being going to segregated schools and things, and they gonna try to tell me that they had a better understanding of what has happened to me than I did. So I asked the email, I said, Brother, you from Jamaica? I said, now, they got big populations of Jamaicans right here in Brooklyn. I been Flatbush. I said, now, if you say that you understand what done happened to me better than I do, I said, I don't believe that because I can't understand why you don't take the language of the email that you say you are attracted to and go and teach your people that. Why you got to stand over me and try to dominate me and tell me about myself better than I know myself? You can't do that. Because they got people from the West in the island. I live around them, right next door to them. And they start talking. I don't know what they're talking about when they're talking that language that they're using in that island. That, it's just like them talking Japanese or Chinese to me, some of them people. And we make a mistake because we say we are all black people. And that's one of the mistakes. That's one of the strongest psychologies they got working on us. Because when you start now, God said every tub must stand on his own bottom. So we're coming to the conclusion of things. And when we start looking, and God said he will not give them us our full blessing until he separates the good from the bad. So when we look at our life history, and I look at what happened to me coming up in the South, my people, yeah, Michael Scarvey, the Honorable Michael Scarvey, he had to leave Jamaica. His own people wouldn't even accept him. He didn't get up off the ground with a big following until he came here among our people. It was people in Harlem. It was our people more than anybody else helping him to get established as a leader here in this new world called America. It was African America. That's why we are Joseph Cotto, Minnie Cotto. Anybody can come here and can fit right in with us and lead us. And that's the biggest mistake that. But it's coming to a abrupt ending, because as long as they got minds like yours, buddy, that young brother with you and me and myself, and that's it don't take no whole lot of us, because I don't want to be nobody else but what God created me to be. So we can't let these people come among us and they're disguised like they got that pattern. I'm familiar with him. And but like these people and Skip Gate, they are the ones that speak to the white man and let the white man know to listen. Now, I'm best qualified, excuse this word, to keep these niggas in check, that professor so-and-so over there, that university, or the one over. I know how to control it. So I think that you ought to let me do a lot of speaking on behalf of what happened to a slave in America. And he gonna give that sister out of the eyes of the white man, because that's what they're in his check. That's what most of them do. The Karango and all of them. He come and take seven principles that he stole out of what the seven verses of the Quran, El-Fatiha, and tell a lie. And this is why we're suffering. And we're under curse, as the Imam said, because we reject that what God has given to us. Our ancestors, Buddy Imam, they prayed for some of their children to be born to serve God. They took an oath with God. They took a pact with God when the white men were putting the hurting on them. And they said, God, if when our children is born, we'll dedicate our children and their lives to obeying you, God, and doing what you want them to do. And most of our leaders have changed that, Buddy Man. And you trying to bring it back. And Buddy Man, I appreciate you, man, because I hear you crying.
I appreciate you.
I hear you crying in the wilderness of North America, Buddy Man. And that's the kind of mind. That's the kind of spirit attack move out your octave heart, soul, and mind, because I'm in the same spirit unit. Brother Mel, we want to be free all the way. All the way, Brother Mel. All the way.
Right.
We don't want to be free halfway. Brother Mel, we want to be free in our intellect, our soul, our heart, our spirit, our rational, and our logical makeup, all the way. And the only one that can give us that is Almighty God, Allah himself. And that's what has happened to us. They have done a psychological damage on us more than any people have ever been damaged in their psyche, but now by telling us and giving us a God that look just like the people that enslave our mothers and fathers. And we have educated people with PhDs and going to church and Rolls Royce and Cadillac and limousine and chauffeur, and they go down to the church and kneel down and cry crocodile tears, looking up at a picture, looking like the man that enslaved their mothers and fathers, denied them freedom, justice, and equality, and calling him their personal savior, and they call him Jesus Christ, and they say he's the Jew. If that ain't a damage to the minds of the people, you tell me, because we have more educated people now that is trying to convince their children and grandchildren that they have to make Jesus Christ their Lord and personal savior. This is not nothing against Christianity. You know that, Buddy, now. This is against the lie that they put on Christ Jesus. And when I be teaching, when I was on the street, I told all of them Christians that would listen to me. I said, I don't know no Christian love Jesus Christ more than that. Why? Because we have a better knowledge of who Jesus is than most of the people in this world, in the Muslim world, in the Christian world, in the Jewish world. We have a better understanding of who the prophet was and what they represented. History, Buddy, now. And Jesus Christ. That's what the Frederick Douglass said to that white man during the time of slavery. Now, he was in slavery, and he stood up and told that white man, Brother Mel, he said, listen, you profess to be Christian. You say you're Christ-like. But the way you treat me and my people will shame a nation of savages, brother. That's what Frederick Douglass told that man. And here we are now. We are the children of these people. And we don't, and Brother Mel, and when God bless some of us to reach high position in Pharaoh's house and in Pharaoh's kingdom. And what do? We put up before the Pharaoh, and we're going to try to convince the Pharaoh that he's a better, or we are better, and what they enslaved us with, we are better to give that and present that to our people than he is. So let me do it for you, boss. Boss, let me do this here for you. Let me be the straw ball. Let me whoop that nigga, boss, because you can't whoop him like I whoop him and take the hate and the frustration out on their own kind. And that's why God says your worst enemy is your own selves, Buddy Man. And that's what is wrong with us. Our worst enemy is ourselves, because we will not stand up for the truth. Jesus Christ stood upon him and said, know ye the truth, and the truth will set you free. He didn't say nothing about singing ourselves out of this condition we're in, or shouting ourselves out of the condition we're in. He said, as a man or woman thinking, not only in their mind, but in their hearts are they. And what did Muhammad the prophet say? Think. Use your five before five deprive you. Or use your five to make progress. And what did the great W.D. Du Bois say what happened to us in the 20th century, or how we ought to make progress? He said the way you teach your children to think. not think any kind of way, D ma'am said, but think for progress, buddy ma'am. And when I hear you coming up on the airways, buddy ma'am, that's the direction that I love to hear you point us to, ma'am. And brother ma'am, keep up the good work, ma'am. We need
you.
Courageous
thank you so much.
Brothers. We need courageous people that need to have the ear of our young children and the old ones too, buddy ma'am. So we not be afraid. God is with us, buddy ma'am. God didn't bring us this for 400 years and let us go through this for us to be on the back burner or be on the bottom. No, he said, I'm going to take the bottom end and put it to the top. I believe we are on the top, buddy ma'am. All we got to do is
I believe that too.
I believe that wholeheartedly we on the top. Buddy ma'am, we are special people, and God has said that. He said, I will raise up a special people. I will love them, and they will love me. That's us, buddy ma'am. Brother ma'am, ain't no, the ma'am told all of these scholars, white, black, brown, red, and yellow. He said, and special the black scholars among us. He said, y'all never be able to understand our condition as a people until you study sincerely the works of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, my father, and my work. You have to study us to see the situation of coming out from slavery into true freedom, justice, and equality. Thank you, brother, for the time, Jeff Kidd.
Thank you. Thank you,
it.
Brother Imam Mubashir. Yes, we thank you. Thank you. Anybody else like to call, make comments? We are discussing with Brother Qadir El-Amin from Lincoln University, an uprising sophomore at Lincoln, and I'm sure a mass communications major. We are discussing with him rituals of blood. I'm going to continue the discussion by asking him to give us a reaction to some of the pictures that we have in this book. Now, these are some very painful pictures. I'm going to turn to them. One of them looking with a poor African man. This is one. On page, I need for sale. To be sold on board, the ship bounty, our people being sold. And we have really a Congo slave on plantation, B.F. Taylor's plantation. And we have a brother, a Mandingo slave on the plantation of Colonel Wade Hampton. He looks just like Professor Suleiman and Yang. What's your reaction when you see those pictures of those slaves? What kind of spirit comes into you?
You know, well, first thing I thought was, you know, especially with the, we as African Americans, we are a new people, but we're also a mix of different West African ethnic groups, and this right here is just proof of it. You know, Renty a Congo slave, Fessina a Mandingo slave in South Carolina. Both of these two fellows in South Carolina. You know, this is just proof that that African Americans are, a myriad of different African ethnic groups, and our culture is a demonstration of that, you know?
Now, let me ask you this. We look at poor Delilah, and she's naked. They get her breast exposed. Is it any wonder that 40 years or maybe 200 years later, we got Nicki Minaj? Is there any connection between Nicki Minaj and this lady who is forced to be naked, and Nicki Minaj that invites her to be naked, and that she calls us looking A and N. Is there any relation?
Definitely. It's a correlation. You know, like you said earlier, these things are not just, they just happen. They learn their reactions, you know, their reactions to certain things, you know. If you're displayed as an object and you see other women displayed, women who of your ethnic group displayed as an object over centuries and centuries, you know, rape, this, and your gradual sense of worth is diminished. And obviously these things get passed down, just like we pass down, stories, you know. These things get passed down. So, yeah, of course it's a correlation.
Now, what about Mr. Rick Ross, also known as Mr. Shepard, the correctional officer? Now, I'm looking here at the Congo slave. is there any correlation between Rick Ross and this Congo slave?
I would say no. No, you know, the Congo slave, he probably had a sense of dignity, a sense of integrity, even though he was enslaved. You know, Rick Ross is a creation of the white man.
Would you explain and elaborate that? How Rick Ross? Now, Rick would say he's getting paid. Rick got him a Rolls Royce. Rick has plenty of gold around his neck. Rick said he's a creation of himself.
I mean, well, his values, Rick Ross's values are really the values that most African Americans hold dear to them. You know, material, and this material, this obsession with material items, is a direct outgrowth of slavery. You know, we couldn't have for so long, and now we think we finally have access to something. You know, and that's not really what's important, but that's, you know, what we think is important. Rick Ross, what he doesn't understand is that the powers that be are using this obsession with material to draw him in to, you know, do whatever it takes to get that money so he can get more material at the cost of his people, at the cost of his listeners, you know.
Let me ask you this about what example. I see most death was recently not allowed back in the country. What other young rappers would you recommend if you're going to chill? Which one of them would you recommend?
Well, I listen to a lot of young people might not know about these rappers, but, you know, they're more 90s rappers, but they're still rapping today. I would say Talib Kweli. Most Def is good, but, you know, The Roots, Nas, and, you know, there are several other in that same vein, in that same category of rappers that, you know,
contemporary rappers, or any of them that you could recommend. What about Kendrick Lamar? I know my sons, they rave about Kendrick Lamar. I don't know anything about him.
Kendrick Lamar, you know, I like to say that rappers sometimes can play the role of sociologists, and their material is really social commentary on what's going on. And Kendrick Lamar, I used to like Kendrick Lamar. You know, he had his first two pieces of material, they were really good. You know, they were social commentary on where he comes from, Compton, California, and what's going on, and issues. And he was pretty positive. But what happens to most rappers is after they make it, After they become so famous, so to speak, their material quality drops, you know. And he had an album, and he has yet to release another album. His album came out in late 2012, but I noticed that the quality was less, and it was watered down compared to his previous works. So what I like to say is, you know, get these guys early stuff. You know, Kendrick Lamar is good, but what's he gonna do next? You know.
Yes. What about the female rappers? What are some of them and what they are saying?
I don't really listen to female artists that much. But what I see a lot of girls. You know, the model is, you know, I guess Nicki Minaj, Beyonce. That's the model. But that's really what the listeners need to know, is that's really a facade. All that is a facade. You know,
also,
if they're given an image of black people, that's not really what the majority of us are. So it makes us want to aspire to that, you know.
Right. So what about Jay-Z? You have any opinion on Jay-Z?
Jay-Z, I never really listened to him that much, but his history, and I don't like the way his dealings, the way he deals with his people. When he once had a label called Rockefeller, I don't really like the way he handled his business in relation to the people he had on his label. You know, I wouldn't say he's kind of slick, but he doesn't really, you know, he seems like a selfish guy.
You're being diplomatic. You know what? let me ask you this. This is very important for parents. What magazines would you read? For example, I keep up with Feds magazine. I don't know whether that's a great magazine to keep up, but and a couple of other ones that I keep up with, Hip Hop News, I believe it is, which gives me a contemporary understanding of what our people are thinking, because I think that's important as a thinker to know what our people are being consuming or consumed by, rather. And I'm gonna move on over to another section of Patterson's book and ask you about this section of Patterson's book. And you can join the conversation at 805-727-7013. We're speaking with our dear brother and dear friend, Brother Adir Elamin. He is the son of, well, he's his own self, a student at Lincoln University. He is the Imam Earl Elamin's son. But, you know, he's an independent thinker. And this is just tells us the crop, the new crop of thinkers that's coming up. He's a mass communications major at Lincoln University. I wanted to ask your comment. Go ahead. We have a caller from, I'll ask you that. We got a caller from Pennsylvania. Caller, you're on the air.
Assalamu alaikum. This is Mujahideen from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. All right. I just wanted to get a brother to greet. I met him maybe sometime last year. We came up with Dehan. He's an alumni there. And we met him, and I think they had an Islam forum or something like that, and they had a guest speaker. And I just want to get a brother greetings. Keep up the good work.
Assalamu alaikum.
Hey, Islam.
You have any other comments, Brother Imam?
No, that was it. Just give me greetings.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm going to read here from page 143 and ask you to comment. The lower class male child of a single woman then has no assistance, no allies within the family, and his struggle to separate from his mother. The neglected clinical literature has documented the serious psychological consequences of this failure to separate, especially when the mother is neglectful or abusive. The case of Virgil, a troubled, anxious 5-year-old analyzed by Dale R. Murray, illustrates the problem. He turns his aggression back on himself in a range of accidents and provoked punishments. Virgil's masculinity has a profound sadistic base, and his compensated defense has led to regressive, passive, effeminate accommodation. Virgil's dominant fears of his painful emergent fantasies and dreams of being a girl. Such passivity and effeminate inclination, however, outrages his self-esteem, and his acting appears as a chronic need to reestablish his sense of masculinity. It is thus easy to see the powerful attraction of the street gang and cool post culture for under and lower class youth. The mother abuses and the promiscuous sexual and physical violence of the street culture acts as a belated but savage effect means of breaking with the mother. Will you comment on that? Any reaction? Have you seen anybody similar to Virgil?
Growing up, I've seen people who suffer from the effects of, you know, growing up without male influence in the home. And I always say it's like, it's several different types of people that are created from this kind of family upbringing, you know. And I always see a lot, you know, you got people who are, you know, a lot of people who are thugs, you know, hardened kind of guys, you know. And then on the other end, you have people who are, you know, who have been brought up this way, but may not have been brought up in the hood, so to speak, and they are people who, you know, they suffer when it comes to relationships to, with women and whatnot because they haven't had male influences in the home.
Yes. So what do you, I don't know whether you have met young men or who have joined street gangs. And if you haven't, well, then you can't comment. But we have a caller that's going to, a caller from 973-419. You're on the air. Religion means alive.
Assalamu alaikum, Imam.
Assalamu.
How do you do, and your host and your guests? How do you all do?
We do well. I do well. I can't speak for him, but this is Imam Earl Alameen's son, and he's Qadir. He's a young man that's studying at Lincoln University. Question or comment?
Alhamdulillah. In regard to the, I believe it's the effect of young men growing up in homes without the influence and perhaps not the direct influence of males. They're getting some examples or information from other men, albeit it might be from the same category of people or men that have the same type of influence. So garbage in, garbage out. What I mean by that is when you put bad information in a container and you go and take that or empty that container of what's in it, what are you going to get? You're going to get some more bad stuff. So I think we have a people, I'll speak specifically to the so-called Negro, and that is the environment in which produced a lot of us without the influence of men like my greatest influence were the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, may Allah forgive him, sin and grant him paradise, and W.D. Muhammad, may Allah forgive him all their sins, and that Islamic influence from a perspective of an intelligent mind. With that said, a lot of young men were influenced by the environment of Western thought. They were produced by women that raised them, like William Lynch said that they should be raised. So, I mean, that to me is a synopsis of it. However, it is it has a great impact on these young men. And our young men today, the majority of them, or should I say a lot of them, walk around like animals, unconscious of the image that they are projecting, or like the beast in the jungle, beast in the woods, that it's dog-eat-dog thing. And let me extend this a little further, and this is my last comment. I was reading in the paper down here in Florida where these two young men went and killed each other's mother because they had an issue with one another. Now, how crazy is that?
Pretty damn crazy, isn't it? What's your opinion? Tell us a little bit more about that story. It's very hard to believe it, but I'm sure it's true.
Well, it was in the Tampa Times. I didn't read it extensively, but I read the caption, and they had the picture of the two young men where they had a beef with one another, and one went and killed the other one's mother, and the other one went and killed that guy's mother. And that's the extent that I read it. And
these were young African Americans.
Young African Americans, about mid 20s or early 20s, and I see the like our illustrious brother El Haj Malik Shabazz said, this is a hatred that hatred produces, and a lot of us haven't broke those chains. Naeem Akbar called it the psychological chains of slavery. We haven't broke those things. We are still under the influences of people that destroyed or attempted to destroy us totally, brother. And it's reflected in our how would I put it, the middle-aged guys and younger, or even maybe some of the older guys, man. They talk garbage. They put garbage out there. They ad lib or they say what they want to say to try to make it sound good that has nothing to do with truth. So I'm sorry to get away from that specific question, but that was the extent of what I read in that article.
Okay. You have any comments, Brother Elamine?
I agree. I guess what we see is the hatred that hatred produced. Simply put.
Yes. I think that when we look at African Americans in the city of Chicago and their descendants of Mississippi, pretty easy to understand. What disturbs me more, and I ask all of you to answer me, why isn't it this resonate more with Muslims? Why are Muslim African Americans, who are probably the most conscientious of African Americans, why are we bothered by this?
Bothered in the sense that we speak of it, or bothered in the sense that we're not doing anything, or bothered in the
sense
that...
That's what I mean, in the sense that we seem not to have any concern that we're Muslim, we go to the masjid. Some of our masajids, and one city is one of the most dangerous areas of the city. I mean, right down Clinton, New Jersey. I'm going to call that city out. And the Muslims come in Friday and State Street and get right into Capitol Clinton. Dangerous area, but they don't seem to have any real concern.
What I've heard with that issue, Brother Imam, is that the leadership, the people that are helping with the administrative aspects of some of these masjid, don't say nothing. You don't want to run them away. And you don't want to hurt and offend them by bringing certain things to their attention. However, I think it's like the flood. Once the gate is open, if you don't have the ark, then you're going to be swallowed up in that. And I think this is what we're getting in some of these messages, brother, that these people come in. They talk smooth. Well, let's not say smooth so much. They talk fast. They talk as though they are committed, and they got a left hand and a right hand situation going on here. They high profile or appear to be practicing the deen. They come with the rhetoric and the rituals of the deen. But
my question is, why isn't the Muslim community troubled by the issues that Brother Elamine and I am discussing, the effects of slavery, issues that Imam Muhammad has put before us, the effects of single-parent homes, just some of the real situations that we have in our neighborhoods that we as a people are affected by? That's what I'm concerned about. Am I clear?
Yes, sir. Well, I believe it.
Oh, no, I was going to have add a comment. This is Jadine, but you go ahead, brother.
I think not being bothered is more of in the line of my family, sister, brother, mother, father, et cetera, et cetera. They got their hand in the pot of America. Some of our hands are dipping with the same blood that is causing the spilling of the blood of our young men, and even the behavior. Dope has ravaged our community. So there are elements, there are situations, Imam, that we haven't changed because we are dipping and diving in it. We're lying.
We have a caller from 347-886. Caller, you on the air with Brother Elamine, student at Lincoln University. Yes.
Assalamu alaikum, Imam Alfred Muhammad and student Qadir Elamine. This is Bilal Keir. I'm calling from Queens, New York, also a graduate, proud graduate of the Lincoln University of Pennsylvania as well. So I'm really very much familiar with Brother Qadir and also his father. I also like to chime in on this topic here of the effects of slavery on us that still lives in our people today. And one of the things that point out to me and continue to point out to me is the effect of how we are so much bamboozled and caught up in the culture of the industry, meaning of the hip-hop culture. Not hip-hop, the hip-hop culture and the other industries where we see celebrities, we see these black men, so-called black men, present themselves in a way that they're supposed to be getting money, they're supposed to have all these women. It's a facade. And this has crept into even Islam, even to us as Muslims here, where we start to even try to follow these individuals, try to emulate these individuals. But we know very well that these individuals represent a culture that's pretty much dead. There is no culture in Hollywood. Hollywood is a dead culture. So what are we following? Who are we trying to emulate from this culture? Because obviously this culture continues to appropriate influences that is not of our way of life, and that's not suitable for our way of life that we call Al-Islam, that we call this being. And you see now they're trying to even kill off the black male by introducing different lifestyles, if you would, that are not conducive for us to grow. So they give you drugs. They give you homosexuality. They give you this. They give you that. And they promote that to you as, well, this is how we want you to live your life.
I'm sorry.
Well, go ahead.
So, brother, you look at, to mention some names, a guy mm-hmm. named Wes and another educated brother, I don't forget his name, they have an ongoing conversation or contention with one another, and they are misrepresenting what is truly the essence of humanity, or should I say the essence of the love and the respect for the individual, the human being, the shared experience of this so-called Negro. And they're tearing that down. They're tearing at one another. And there's a lot of this stuff that go on. I got to tear you down so that I can be up. And the only way I can fill up is that I got to make you think that you are less than me. These things are called one of the seven sins, deadly sins they are called. And I can appreciate that terminology. And the people that want to get out of that have to form alliances, get involved with like-minded people, and fight this thing like hell, brother, because if we don't, our grandchildren, they're going to be caught up in the same mess, man. And I go back to earlier years when the idea was that we are sacrificing, or we did sacrifice our youth for our own self-aggrandizement. We taught them how to be this type of person. We took their dirty money. We allowed them to get out there and prostitute and call themselves pimping women, selling dope, because we got some benefit. Because now our mothers had difficult times taking care of some of us in the hood environment. Of course, there was a concerted effort to keep these people down, poor, and deprived. But we don't see that. We don't see the hand that is operating and manipulating our consciousness, our minds and our hearts and our children. As you were speaking of the influences, we'll miss that, or we don't care about it. That's sad. And I speak to it a lot to these young men. Man, why you walk around with your pants hanging down? They'll pull them up for a second, but they go right back down. And I don't think they realize that this is like the animal in the jungle, man, the animal in the wilderness, in the wild, that your humanity is gone. It's been destroyed by whatever you're ingesting. And the people that's conscious, man, I believe we are the people, and I hope Allah bless me to be amongst those people that's conscious, that's acting, doing, and speaking out against this type of behavior to whatever degree I can and we can. And another thing, too, brother, there's some of us that call ourselves Muslims. We are still stealing. We're still smoking, drinking, lying to our women, lying to ourselves. And we got this abusive thing that we think we can beat these women. Crazy stuff. So it's just in lip professing. It's not in the heart. That's what I would say. But then I maybe I'm still overstepping some boundaries. But when you look at a person's behavior, his deeds or his action speaks volumes for him. So that's what I would say about some of this, man.
We have one more caller. We're just about out of time, but let's take this caller. Brother Alameen, you got more callers than we have had in years. So, hey, man, second generation, you're definitely into mass communication. We got to bring you back. Yes, caller from Los Angeles, California. Los Angeles no longer lost.
Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Well,
I just want to put my two cents. And we have to heal ourselves.
Hey, put your $1 million in. I know you got it. $1 million worth of thought. Yes.
Yes, sir. We have to heal ourselves. And one of the ways that, you know, we can heal ourselves is to speak out whenever we know the answer. You know, I heard your earlier caller, Imam Mubashir, you know, he talked about, you know, like that image. You know what I mean? And, you know, looking just like the slave master. Well, you know, sometimes we need to tell people that, you know, in a very, very casual, nice way, you know, explain to people that concept so that'll help heal them and heal ourselves, too, heal ourselves as we do this. And then my last point is about this sagging pants. So, you know, I don't want to be too graphic, and I don't want to be, you know, too pornographic. But this sagging pants came out of California. It was, you know, it came out of homosexual prison.
Mm-hmm.
Homosexual prison, you know?
Yep.
And in prison, these homosexuals, what they do, they wear their underwear backwards and have the hole in the back, in their pants. And then they go around sagging in the penitentiary. And so this is an easy access. They could go in a corner and go wherever, and they could do a sex act. So these people who are promoting this, it came out of the media, it came out of the entertainment culture.
Mm-hmm.
They're making mockery. They're making mockery of these young black males. They laugh at us and say, look at these young black males. They don't know. They think they're being hard, but they actually are imitating, mocking homosexual prison life. And we have to slow down and tell these youngsters that. Whenever I tell them, I'll tell some of them, I don't say, they say some of them, because I teach a juvenile hall here. And some of them say, well, you know something, I don't say, that's what they'll tell you. Some of them, see, they want, after I tell them that story, you know what I mean, and then they want to escape from that. But some of them is hardcore, they don't believe it. But you have to at least tell them, and that's what I want to say to.
Well, we certainly are not out of message. We got plenty of message, but we are out of time. And let me just make a housekeeping message before we go. You can, everybody can participate, and we have all you on here. You can, this week is the last week, because we'll have a post office box. But until then, you can send your donations to Imam Alfred. But on the top, Religion Means Alive, Imam Alfred Muhammad, 817 Jackson Avenue, Linden, New Jersey, 07036. We have a weekly bill. We put an ad in the Amsterdam News. We put an ad in the Muslim Journal. We're in the Journal every week. It's not free. Mr. Levy, who owns Blog Talk Radio, expects money from me every month. Everybody else does. I'm asking each and every one of you on the air to send us a donation. Whatever it is, I can't tell you what to send. You know your situation better than I. But not only send your donation, tell 10 people. Do what I do. Every day I speak to 10 people to tell them something about this great message that we have gotten. You know, I don't have to say Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, K-Pile. I just say, brother, how you doing? I want to talk to you, man. I say something that's going to uplift them. So I ask you to support this ministry, and we eventually will take this program on the road in a city near you. So please send your donations to Imam Alfred Muhammad, 817 Jackson Avenue, Linden, L-I-N-D-N, New Jersey, 07036. That is Imam Alfred Muhammad, 817 Jackson Avenue, Linden, New Jersey, 07036. We'll be on the air again tomorrow.
Inshallah.
With Reconnect to you, how to be a mentor to your child self with Brother Nazim Rashid. Followed Thursday by a healthcare program with Dr. Elamine. Friday we will have Debunking the Myth of Ham. We'll be back again Saturday for an open forum. Sunday I will give the first Sunday address, which is Education, the Vital Link, and Freeing Our People. We've been on the air now about 3 years. We're going to continue by God's grace and His mercy. Continue to swing the axe until the walls of Jericho come tumbling down. And every one of the 41 million African Americans know of the great inheritance that God has given them through the teachings of Imam Waqif Muhammad. Not here to invite people to be Muslims. Not here to invite people to be Christians. We are here to invite you to your sanity and to your humanity. Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. We thank Brother Elamine, who so eloquent and so beautifully provoked a powerful discussion. And we look forward to seeing you tomorrow on Religion Means a Lie.